Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Brain Trust podcast. My name is Adam Vass, and I'm a tabletop game designer in Southern California.
My name's Layups. I'm a tabletop game designer in York, Ontario, Canada. Adam, what's up?
Just another episode of the Brain Trust.
That is that signature energy.
I feel like if I talk about it explicitly, we will get demonetized. We don't make anything from this. And also, we won't get banned because there's not enough on an audience to... Maybe we already were banned, but...
You got your 5G injection.
I was... what's a good word? Through a scientific application, given resistance to a particular threat. I don't think any of those would ping the government.
I can see you mentally checking your brain thesaurus.
Yeah, on the podcast. mostly it's because I'm fidgeting and looking at shit all the time, and I feel like this was going to keep me focused. But I've been extremely tired for close to a week now. I guess it's not close to a week. A few days now. And we took last week off. I think the scientific experiment is compounded with just being exhausted from everything.
Yeah,
for sure. From work. And so we took last week off, which you would think, wow, it's been 2 weeks since we've done this. We're going to be fresh out the gate. We're going to be...
Yeah, it's going to be... We don't do anything other than record this podcast. We didn't take a week off to prep to launch a Kickstarter in June and get the game design ready. And we weren't handling our own shit at that point.
Yeah. It's just life coming at you.
I was sitting in this chair. Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that I got this new desk pad thing. You ever use one of these like desk covers?
I have a cutting mat that is my desk cover.
Self-healing.
Yeah, it's one of those.
I love that shit.
The Wolverine.
Every time I like cut something hard on a cutting board and it makes a notch in it, I'm like, I can't wait to see the secret behind the scenes magic next time. Like, I can't wait for the crew to get this one figured out.
I have an edge on mine that never self-healed, and it's like right where my forearm rests on my desk, and I know I just am constantly aware of it. I wonder if, does Wolverine have to like charge his healing power?
Well, so in Highlander, a movie I watched last night, the Highlanders can only get killed if you cut off their heads. So I think we found the neck of your cutting board.
It's the edge.
Yeah. But I got this new one, and it's two-sided, and one side is... It's also pleather, but one side is such a color and feeling that it's like I'm resting my arms on human flesh just while typing and sitting at my desk.
Just reading Wikipedia and...
while just getting some skin hunger on a cold mat. That's kind of my new thing.
Have you reversed it? I feel like it's... You know, great intention to have a reversible mat, but the second you put your keyboard down, you're never flipping it.
I flipped it and reversed it. Nam flammable. I have the darker side up, so it kind of just looks... what color is this? I think Seb said, like, burnt pink. What did you say?
Dusty Rose.
Dusty Rose. What is the difference? Dusty Rose is a wrestler.
Classic wrestler.
Yeah, Dusty Rose.
Father of Gold Dust.
Yeah, I have been playing a video game that I'm recommending everyone. Obviously, it's a game that's been out for a while, if it's a video game that you and I are playing. it's been out for a long time. But I've been playing a game called Science of the Sojourner. Have you heard about this game?
Only from your text, and I didn't look it up.
Well, get ready.
Not for any reason.
Buckle your seatbelt. It's been a week. It's been flammable. What have you put together? All the sounds that the Bare Naked Ladies made and all the reverse words of Missy Elliott. What would we have if I had $1 million? Anyway, it is a extremely beautiful game. The music is so good. I am moved to tears every time I get to one town. It's very wild. And it's a game where you go away from your hometown on a caravan and you go talk to other people in other towns and you try and get stuff to help your town stay on this caravan route. Otherwise, you might get taken off and it will hurt the town and hurt everybody in it. And you're taking over for your mom who passed away. And the game is played with a deck of cards that represent the way you have conversations. And so conversations can be open and emotive or logical and direct or imaginative and creative or brash and straight to the point. And these are all represented. These four categories are represented through shapes. So you're just matching these cards and shapes while having these conversations with people. And you need like a certain amount of successes to get further with these conversations or to have what's called a dissonant conversation or a consonant conversation. So it's not like good or bad, but it's like, are you reading each other? Are you talking to each other in a way that you both understand? And in this time of quarantine, not talking to a lot of people, not meeting new people, not going new places, it is like hitting me on this level I forgot existed. That's like, wow, this is something that I didn't realize how important was to me as a person. And like this way of conversation is just so beautiful. And the game is so beautiful. And the music's so great. And there is a dog you can talk to. Like, it's a great game. Every game designer should go play it. It is just a perfect execution of clean tabletop mechanics with beautiful art, music, and great writing.
I just watched the trailer while you were doing the pitch. It looks sort of like what I thought Griftlands was going to be. Which is another deck builder game that I was playing on Steam that's kind of all right. The difference in Griftlands is the setting is immediately like bleaker, but you have two separate decks. One is combat and one is negotiation.
Oh, I see.
And
I'm going to play that after this.
You never have an A versus B. Like, it's always combat versus combat or negotiation versus negotiation. And they both work in ways that mechanically feel extremely similar. In combat, you can have defense or shields or whatever. And in negotiation or in conversation, you have like arguments that can function the same mechanically as like, it's like fight. A debate.
Yeah.
And because of that, it doesn't feel novel. It doesn't feel like I'm doing two different things. It's just like I'm fighting, but they're word cards.
Yeah, I'm still rolling my GURPS dice to do this thing. The beautiful thing about Signs of the Sojourner is that you begin your deck. You've got a pre-made deck and you can only have 8 cards and you get fatigue cards the further away you go from town. And those cards like fill your hand. Because as we all know, there's sometimes times where you're so worn out and tired that you actually just can't hold up the conversation or like connect with somebody in the way that you might if you're fully rested and shit. But you start with 2 symbols in your deck. Different cards have different symbols on them. And every time you have a conversation with somebody, you choose one of their cards that they used. Because every time you connect with somebody, whether you know it or you don't, you take away a piece of that. Like every time you connect with this podcast, you take away a piece of maybe a slurp noise. Maybe you do learn a little bit about flesh hunger. But yeah, it. So the further away you go, the pace of conversation in the city is different from your small town. So you get some city cards, you go to this artist collective thing town, and you get the artist cards, but you're still balancing like, okay, I might talk to somebody from the city in this town or whatever. So you just have all these like cool little puzzle challenges that feels all collaborative. There's no violence. Everyone's in this game is establishing a workers cooperative. It's awesome. But the hardest breaking as shit is that every time you go on one of these caravans around the whole area, There's like 10 towns or something like that. It's 50 days long ish each trip. And when you come back, you have to have a conversation with like your childhood friend who has not changed the way that they talk because they haven't had to speak to other people. So you realize how much you change and how much you talk past each other in reality after your life experience. And yeah, it's really good. I can't iterate enough that the music is amazing.
It looks like the soundtrack is on itch.
Yeah, you everyone. Oh, wait. Hey, everybody, you already own this because it was in the Racial Justice Bundle. So
the game.
Yeah.
It's also on Switch now, it looks like. It's on Steam, and you should, yeah, if you don't somehow have it, oh, you can get it on PlayStation. It seems like it's everywhere.
Go get it. Listen to it with headphones. It, like, to talk about the music for a second, do you know when a musician loves the sound of their own instrument in a way that's just like all purity and you hear fingers on strings and stuff like that?
Sure.
Yeah, it just sounds like the ultimate shit. It's just so good. Anyway, maybe we should talk about using card mechanics to in novel ways for games and things like that. We wouldn't know much about designing card games, right?
Try as I might to to stay away, I cannot.
It's weird how good cards are.
My general approach is to only use dice and note cards. And then whenever I make a game that is... What's the way to... I was going to say just like more unique, like obviously Guide, the way Guide uses cards. So the other thing is these aren't just like poker cards. Like we're talking about bespoke, like creating a card.
Special cards.
And it is just really good to do. Like the mentality of wanting to use dice and no cards is to make it utilitarian, but it's also utilitarian to have a game be self-contained and have all the pieces that it needs to be played. And if your game is just a deck of proprietary cards, then that is as utilitarian as offering the supplies.
I think there's a real reason why The Quiet Year is everybody's favorite game. Like, everybody's real favorite game.
It's cards.
I think it's cards. I think, like, having a game that has a specific deck that represents, like, now I am playing this game, I am opening the tuck box on this game. Feels different.
That's interesting, because I don't own the physical copy, so the implication is that I just would use poker cards, which is fine, too.
Let me tell you about this tuck box.
Which is fine, and I think the same of games like The Wretched, where it's like, well, the thing, okay, we're talking about cards. This is interesting because, so to recap from 2 weeks, because we had a little break, that we're doing the Tech Jam this month, letting gamers, game designers bring in tech packs or like mechanical insights and whatever to itch. And the thing that I did was about how much information you can gather from just a single roll of 2d6. And I think there's a really, like, mind-blowing amount of additional information in a deck of standard playing cards.
Yeah, that is, like, one of the most important takeaways from the Design Games podcast for me by Nathan D. Pallette and Will Hindmarch was their cards episode that I just think about often. I'm designing a card game for Lucian Khan's Hibernation Games that is played with a deck of poker cards. And a card has so much information on it that the design is choosing what to ignore on the card.
Right.
Because you can't use it all. Because if you are not just playing a straight up poker game or a poker style game and you are reassigning, like, to break a jack of hearts down into elements, you got to know the four suits, the value of the jack card, the value of it being a face card, like within its suit, and its context with other cards. So a Jack of Hearts could be in a Royal Flush, unlike other, etc. There's so much stuff.
Right. You even have just like the color binary too of red and black, which is like this wider section of suiting.
It's even more than tarot. You have like, there are three face cards that are like explicitly men. Like there's royalty involved with them. They're not just like important, but they have like a context. They're such a standardized tool that aside from tarot is like this as well. But I talk about this one time where we were waiting for people to show up to a game night, and we organized every tarot card based on the type of shoes that people were wearing in it. So like all the steel toe shoes, all the cloth shoes, all the bare feet, all the no feet. All the no feet folks. But that's just a good exercise to do with tarot if you want to learn tarot. This is kind of going lots of directions, but that's fine. We're in the first 15 minutes. This is great. I already talked about a video game and how it makes me want to cry all the time. Just take a tarot card and pick one element or color or thing. Like, how many tarot cards have cities in the background? And then make a diorama based around the cities in the background and try and pinpoint where that city is, like geographically, for the people in the tarot. So what I'm saying is, I was just running through, I was playstorming this game to write for this this collection that will be super cool. My game's due at the end of the month. I don't know why you need to know that, but that's for me. The game is called Drawing Dead, and you are like, not the god of death, but you are like the Mike Ehrmantraut of death. So you go and find the people who can't be found. Like, death is so busy on a daily basis doing its thing, reaping souls and etc., that you are tasked, like, you're like the special investigation. So you go and find the people who have deliberately held something, maybe made a death pact or something like this. So the game is played, you are the dealer to four phantom players, and each of those players, their hand that you will reveal through the playing of the game, connects them each to each other and then connects them to what their death pact was about. And you play three rounds over three different types of poker games. So it starts with five card stud, and then hold'em, and then blackjack, each representing a different level of what you got. So in five card stud, you know the least about them, so you're discovering that. With hold'em, there's this big river in the middle that represents their shared connections, and their hidden cards are what they're hiding. And then blackjack, of course, it's one visible card and one face down card, and that hidden card represents their fate to you, the thing. And so I'm just sitting here, like, balancing the hundreds of elements I could put to each suit, representation, matches, things like that, while still keeping this really strong poker motif. And it is analysis paralysis from a game design perspective. Like, how do I go from there? What do I do? And it just kind of turned into crossing shit off a list of things I could do. Like, we are designing a game together, Adam and I. And Adam did this thing. Do you want to talk about this process you did with the spreadsheet?
Oh, so yes, I do. Because I've actually used it a couple times since then, too, in other games.
And it was incredibly inspiring.
So this whole... Yeah, this is a tangent. Maybe let's throw a break here. And like, I'll talk right now, but in editing,
this I'll might just, be... Okay, we'll say, like, we'll take a break, and then... Welcome back to the Brain Trust Podcast. Take it frigging away.
So a thing that I've been extremely interested in and how it relates to my approach of design is procedural generation. Not so there are two main examples that I've already implemented that people who are listening might already know. The first of which is obviously Scratch and Claw, that has effectively a spreadsheet with 10 columns, and each one has 30 to 60 entries in it. And then the card, the character card that you get is a scratch off that reveals one entry from each column. So you have over a quintillion possible permutations of this same data. So no character cards are going to be the same, because I also only have 1,000 cards. So it's statistically impossible that two of them are going to be the same.
You need to be getting in, like, what is it, the millions of cards to start seeing.
To maybe see, like,
it's the birthday effect. You know about this?
That if, like, enough people are in the same room, like, two people have the same birthday.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Because you can, the likelihood that two players have the same starting item is probably 1 in 45. So, like, it's not unheard of. But there's so many other variables at play that you have just an incredible amount of permutations. And the only way I could quantify that is with a spreadsheet. And the interesting part of that, too, is like I was trying to think of how to digitally release that game and how to have character creation be part of it. And it'd be like I could have a D20 table for each of these columns, and it still wouldn't be all of the information that's codified into the game. So I just didn't, because it felt like to undermine the amount of data there would make it slightly less fun. And it also just makes it like a lot of the fun is just in revealing these pre-generated secrets instead of making your own. So that's one example. The other is when I made a Twitter bot for Necronautilus that generates settings. And this is the one that's more relevant to what I'm going to get into, but it's effectively a Mad Lib in the same way that Necronautilus planet generation is, where you say like a blank planet full of blank, or avoid the blank planet in fear of blank. So even that like prepositional phrase between planet and the final blank is its own blank. So I've then crafted through a spreadsheet all these permutations. So the first column is visit or beware or inhabit or whatever, just like a command. And then the blank planet, which is usually nouns and adjectives that would describe the location. And then even planet is a variable because it could be a moon or a satellite. But I've weighted so that planet is 9 times out of 10 the word that gets used. And then the other two are edge cases. So that's neat when they come up. When I see one that's like, visit this satellite, I was like, oh, a rare one.
Don't mind if I do.
This is shiny. But basically, using the theory behind Necronautilus generation as Mad Libs and word implementation, putting it into a spreadsheet that then combines different word segments to be logical sentences, and then having Twitter post those every 4 to 6 hours to see the results. And like, that one, too, I've seen repeats, like certain words will come up more often because it is truly random, which is another weird thing that's a topic for another day, is like the idea, the human perception of randomization being different from true randomization. Anyway, so I'm really interested in letting a spreadsheet show me these permutations rather than, and some of them, like those are both narrative ones, the Scratch and Claw and Necronautilus ones, they have mechanical effects, but they are pretty strictly setting and lore and character focused narrative stuff. So what we did, or what I did for our game, is take these instances of interactions that could take place.
Yeah.
So column A is who is doing an action. Is it the active player? Is it the non-active player? Is it the game itself in some sort of automation? Then B, column B, is what it is that they could be doing. So giving, taking, offering, requesting, flipping, like just sort of everything you could do like physically with these tokens. Then C is the object of that action. who's receiving it. So again, it's a non-active player, an active player, the board, a card on the board. And through this process, and then, you know, et cetera, down the line of all the different variables that could be taking place, like what does the action beset? What is the narrative consequence or mechanical consequence of taking it? And to whom does it apply? Let the spreadsheet tell me these nearly 2,000 combinations so that then we could go look through the list and say, here's one we didn't think of. Oh, we didn't consider what happens when the non-active player interacts with the board during an active player's turn.
Right.
And like, so there's an interesting thing on the design side of, we obviously didn't codify 2,000 combinations of actions. Yeah. We looked at them, saw the ones that we were already using, and I could just like highlight those cells in green in the spreadsheet and be like, oh, we caught this one, or this one's already accounted for. You could also find some weird spreadsheet redundancies, or like the
which
board
in itself is interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Board with board is a great
the board
example.
Requests a coin from the board. It's like, how? That's wild.
Yeah.
But like, maybe.
Yeah. So like, a lot of that speaks to both our definition and curation of this like play space. That's when you get to like atomically, what is your game doing and what are people doing in it? And so Adam doing this, just research and random generation curation, revealed like very gameable shit that is in the game. And
yeah, this and stuff we would have missed because of just like, whether it's preconceived notions or taking like understanding that we know all of the combinations, right? Like in your head as game designers, there's only players in the board and we get it. But like,
and also we're really close to the design and my MacBook hasn't played yet. I haven't sat down and played with MacBook yet. So
yeah, there's a really interesting exposing of not things that you ignore or take for granted necessarily, but just like, it's the most thorough it can possibly be.
Yeah, exactly.
You think you know every combination. Here is literally mathematically every combination. And I don't think I read every 2,000 cells, because there also becomes a point where I can see like six of them in a row that I'd be like, this whole section is kind of not. But that's, it's still like a valid combination of terms. It's just like, we don't need these.
Yeah, it makes you also justify and strengthen the actions that you do have.
Yeah, because obviously with role playing, you don't make a rule for every possible edge case. I think this is probably a tool that gets used a lot in strategy game and board game stuff.
It has to, right?
Yeah. Right, because they do have to plan for edge cases and stuff. Sorry, we're just build different.
Yeah, but we're fucking computer game. Now we're strategy game designers. This is there's a great GDC talk about Keyforge and the random generation used in Keyforge, which is a game that the talk is called either jokingly or not, the world's only unique card game. And each deck you get is different. There's different elements randomly generated. And there is this concept of the act of experiencing procedurally or randomly generated content is like walking through a beautiful forest you have never been to before. You know what forests look like, you know how to walk through a forest, but this particular forest is new to you and you get to discover it maybe for the first time for you or ever. And I am really interested in this. I think you're doing the coolest shit in tabletop, especially RPGs right now, with this random generation. I feel like we are really good on pick lists and die tables. Like, in comparatively, it is a magnitude of difference between what is 10 mahogany sentences and like the entire wood chipper recreating furniture. Like,
yeah, I can't remember if I did this on stream or not, but on Tuesdays I hang out with Spencer Campbell on the Gila RPGs Twitch, and I'm developing a game using Spencer's Lumen system that is loosely based on Overwatch, but it also has some, because of my proclivities, demons and shit. but a thing I did too. So the idea of this game is you have character selection instead of character creation. Because that's the thing that interests me. And like, it's awesome. Like Mortal Kombat, I mean, it comes from Overwatch, where it's like these characters have allegiances and you get little nuggets of setting and lore through their dialogue and even just like the way that they're built and their costumes and what kind of guns they use. So I did make a spreadsheet that was dissecting Overwatch characters into like what class they are, what weapons they use, what shape.
Type of white person with blonde hair they are.
That game has a lot of people from other cultures in it.
Still barely. What Overwatch has a problem with the amount of just straight up Aryans in that game. It is wild.
There's a lot. I mean, this is a whole nother thing. Blizzard is one of the champions of pretending to be inclusive. Yeah. Or like, you know, releasing a comic book that says one of these characters is queer. And it's like, it's not in the game, though.
Yeah.
Like, you can say that, but it's not in the game, though.
It's so cynical. Like, I remember, this is fully tangent mode, but I remember playing a lot of Overwatch. There's a thing where, like, when you play a bunch of Overwatch and then you don't for 6 months, it then just looks like a visualizer for a dubstep concert, like, when you come back to it, because they're just new colors and shit. But I remember, like, new characters waiting to be dropped, and it was like, okay, you know, we got, like, this big German Aryan guy, and we got this, like, white lady, also Aryan, kind of, and then we also got the soldier guys. And then they were like, yes, okay, great, we've got a new one. He is a black man, and he's a criminal and a warlord.
Or the drop one, it's like, it's a hamster, actually, literally.
Oh, awesome. Damn, that's great. Yeah, they make all of their characters who are people of color, like, criminals or whatever. Yeah, Blizzard is pretty pathetic when it comes to that.
But to bring it back, I use a spreadsheet to basically remix these character aspects to generate new characters that are informed by, and then I would also go in and be like, I could add things that suited my setting to the spreadsheet. So I would have things that were Overwatch inspired, especially I'm thinking specifically a lot of the weapons list. Mm-hmm. Of like, I could take every weapon in Overwatch and make a column in a spreadsheet, but I also want to add a pitchfork because there's demons involved, and I want to add you know, like, incendiary tools and stuff.
Yeah,
so I just throw that in the column too, because that's the other novel aspect of this style of generation, is because you're controlling every column. They don't have to be equal. They don't, in fact, I think they're better when they're not. Scratch and Claw has 70 different types of animals, but only 30 types of social skills. So in this character gen, I basically could remix all these aspects of what makes a character, and a lot of it was informed initially by Overwatch builds, but could be extrapolated anywhere, and then allow it to give me these 5-word combinations that effectively boil down a character to enough to give me an idea to make it fully realized. So
right.
Actually, I have the notebook next to me. I'm going to read one, because it's a little, talking about it in the abstract is a little bit abstract.
German man with blonde hair.
So one of them I have made, like, so the generation of words that the spreadsheet gave me was melee, boxy, shotguns, comedy. So
wow.
Their weapon proclivity is short range, and they have shotguns. Their physical shape is boxy, because that's the other thing. Overwatch character design is actually pretty solid in making their
silhouettes
very bespoke. So that was a whole section of my spreadsheet, was just like the general shape, because I'm going to be drawing all these characters. But from that, I got, you know, either a former pro wrestler or stuntman, like a cocky, slick, like showy person who this short range, like, blast damage. Kind of what's that dude from Mortal Kombat who's an actor?
Johnny Cage.
Yeah, it's that energy of just like...
Can you read the description one more time? I think I had a different thing.
Yeah, melee, boxy, shotguns, comedy.
Elmer Fudd.
Yeah, pretty on point.
Elmer, this is Elmer Fudd's time to shine. I need that guy to come back.
But I basically, I have close to 20 characters generated through this procedure, and I don't know how many of them I'll develop further, but this was like at least a fun exercise at the very least.
Yeah.
Like, I have one of them that is like a walking 3D printer that prints toxins and makes little egg mines, like little landmines that hatch into other little That's spiders great. And shit. And it's just like a creepy robot. So it's area control triangle alchemy constructed. That's its
oh neat
spreadsheet output. And I'm like, okay, so it's something that someone made to do this like potion work. And it's an area control build, so that's different than just like a gun build. So how would you do that with chemicals? And I'm picturing those like weird food 3D printers or like liquid 3D printers.
Oh, yeah.
Where it just has all these vials all over it, and it just knows to print these combinations to make like noxious gas in this area or whatever. Like,
so it sounds like you're using this process to then build the characters that will be selectable during the game, but also sounds like this process itself is super fun.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I think that's
generating something... and then curating a list and then seeing what it spits out and then making sense of it. It feels like there's some gameable shit in that.
The Necronautilus bot is extremely that, where it's like making the sentences that describe a planet, but there's not enough there for, I mean, there's enough there that to extrapolate it, but that is still a player facing action to extrapolate. So like I did one earlier this year where I used a Twitter generated sequence to make a one page adventure sheet about this moon that had a horse factory on it. And after the moon was abandoned, the factory stayed open, but it would just keep recycling the same horse parts and like horse in air quotes. So you have these souls that are captured in a horse shaped bodies that are just like cannibalizing each other and getting run through this meat grinder for centuries to utter insanity and just like disgust. And so you as players then go to either shut down the factory, or obviously the creatures in there have been run through this grinder so much that they probably don't know anything about themselves. So I can relate. Having an outsider come in is innately threatening and different. Like,
yeah.
And that was all. That was a really interesting and fun adventure to write, but it came from this procedural generation of like the malicious moon filled with Equestria or something like that. Like, it's just a sequence of words that I would have never made on my own.
Yeah, it is like an inspiration tool that you have built for yourself.
Built for myself, and then I feel like the in the Necronautilus one, making that public or making the iterations of it public through the Twitter bot hopefully encourages us a different style of play, right? Because that game thrives on in the moment just interpretation.
Yeah.
But I understand too that is a challenge a lot of the time for certain players. So even just having your Mad Lib already filled out is one step removed of the work that you have to do to make something really weird and unique. But the thing that you interpret from that sentence is still going to be yours and weird. So I would like to find other ways or better ways to implement a public-facing procedural generation besides just... I mean, there is, of course, I could just send the link to the spreadsheet. Say like, here's my spreadsheet that I used. But to bring it back to mechanical facing stuff, what we're doing with showing all these permutations of actions that could take place, because that has no innate narrative effect, right? The narrative effects is what we prescribe to the already generated sequence of words. That I think is a super useful, maybe I'll throw it in Tech Jam, because that's the thing that game designers could benefit from. And it's a process that takes place invisibly already. Like, you're already thinking about all the ways players can interact with one another during play and accounting for the ones that you deem the most appropriate or most important. But having a computer tell you literally every combination is different from you brainstorming as many as you can.
Right. And playstorming the actions, that they're just going to be blind spots that shit catches. That's so key. And it's not just for games that include like a play space and have currency and things like that. You can extrapolate this to any design that you want it to with like robust interplay. This is just something that you should be considering. How do you make sure you know everything that your game could do to find out what your game should do?
Yeah, there's print definitely that. some belonging outside belonging tech too, of like you interact with these tokens to do particular moves, and having that again, like you understand the premise of that system already when you're building in it, but having a computer tell you every combination is actually extremely valuable, because then you can weigh the ones that you want to include or see the ones that I think I come back to a lot that I've been like freaking out over for some reason. It's just like what it feels like to take an action. Like,
yeah.
In addition to just like, it's my turn and I want to roll dice, and rolling dice besets this consequence. I think a lot, like, this is a thing in Aether Operations too, because Aether Operations' main mechanic involves gambling. What does it feel like to make a safe bet versus an all-in? Like, the risk-reward stuff is a really interesting thing to play with. A spreadsheet probably, if I had been thinking about this back then, probably would have helped the core mechanic of that game a little bit. But, yeah, just, like, what does it feel like as a player to take these particular things? So coming back to ours, like having the board offer a coin to the board, obviously we could write that off because it doesn't suit what we needed, but there is a game where that is a cool thing. Yeah. And it elicits a really interesting different feeling for a player to be like, this game has a degree of autonomy, whether it is pushing our story in a direction, whether it's resisting our influence, or even just like whether it operates on some level without our input. Those are three very different feelings, but each one could make its own game. Like, you could build a whole game around that feeling. I think like that's sort of what a Ouija is, or like a spirit board, of like the idea that the board has some degree of autonomy while you're all interacting with it.
You're playing with the board instead of playing on the board.
Right.
Like,
and
yeah,
you could integrate some, like a spreadsheet, this procedure could highlight aspects like that, autonomous things that happen on their own that you could build into game design that make for that sort of, it's not necessarily a lack of autonomy, but it's just a different feeling. Like, it's a really interesting idea that, yeah, you're playing with the game, and that could be really fascinating.
Yeah, I do know that the original Ouija board designers did use some generation stuff to figure out, you know, what to put, what words to put on the board. So like, yes, no, I am a ghost. I'm goodbye. Here right now. Yeah, goodbye. Hello, Luigi. Things like this. But I do... differently for moves, this is something, or actions, I think about all the time, specifically like, do you call them actions or moves? Like, what is the verb you're using for player interaction with the game? How do you strictly define that? Like, it's such a big thing in Torque, because there is a very strict like turn-based strategy thing and then very open stuff. So I'm being very particular about what verbs I'm using when. So on the road, there are actions because you move a car. That's something I ran into at one point. But when you're at a rest stop, there are activities and moves because they are more open-ended and can extend. Like,
and they're sort of more choice-driven. Yeah. I think a move is something you choose to do and pursue, and an action is something that you like... you do, like you take. Yeah,
an action indicates the ending of the action.
Right.
Like, an action, I shoot a gun, okay, the bullet comes out of the end or whatever. A move is like, you are not, this is extremely pedantic, but a move feels like you're opening the door to a scene to happen. You have intentions for the scene and you might have a way you want it to go. But when you take a move, this is mostly Apocalypse World. You will be surprised, definitionally.
I think, I mean, you know, I love some pedantic language in a rule book, but that is probably, yeah.
It's just gotta be, yeah.
Naming the thing that you do as a player is, like, the most paramount facet of design.
Yeah, and it's, in as clear terms as possible. Like, yeah, you're totally right. It is invisible. It's something that, like, if it's done right, no one thinks twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah. But if you screw it up or you make it weird, then it becomes a hangnail on your design.
Yeah. And, like, we're generally talking about games that have a lot of live elements that we aren't designing down to turn 1.1.2. Like, we're not there. This game that we've been using as an example has tons of live elements that just needs a free-flowing thing to work. Like, there's no decimal point turn things. But, yeah.
I mean, you could think about a really free game. So I'm developing another story game, which I don't think I'm supposed to talk about yet, but in like 2 weeks, it's going to get announced. So and it is story and scene generative based, but there is an aspect of like numbers involved or like currencies and not currency resources involved. It's sort of if a story game had a strategy game pretense. I think that's a thing we talk about a lot, like the board game story game hybrid.
Yeah, currently this is our wave. Like that.
Right. So I'm doing another one. But I'm thinking
I got some in the tank. Yeah, I feel you hit it.
Something like, so to blow it out, something like Fiasco, which is a free form, very loosey goosey game, could sort of benefit from that 1.1 procedure of like on a player's turn, they step one, establish a scene. And then like 1A, establishing a scene means choosing a setting, choosing the characters involved, deciding the focus. And it does have this in the rule book as just general advice. But the idea, and I think this is something I'm sort of using because this game I'm working on is targeted at new gamers or people who maybe think they're buying a strategy game and then they're going to end up telling a story, is procedurizing the storytelling in that sort of formulaic way that still has enough wiggle room. Because I think generally a story game says, here's a thing that somehow randomly generates your prompt, whether it's looking on a dice table or flipping a card, whatever, some sort of nudge in the direction. And then you go. And I think mine, this build particularly has, because one, there's a bookkeeping aspect to keep with this air quotes strategy. It's not really a strategy that you can win or lose. It's just more of a
element.
Information aspect of like quantifying the things that you're doing in a metatextual way. Because it's about a planet that's dying and you're trying to move off of it, so you have a resource that is basically the remaining plant life force of the planet, and that's a number that goes down but you can kind of affect with actions and stuff. So having that bookkeeping and numerical stuff married to scene and prompt and narrative choice stuff is interesting. And I think bundling them together is actually a boon for new gamers. Yeah. I think it's a thing we talk about too a lot of like, and they were talking about it on the call-in show this morning of just like taking, not necessarily taking the audience for granted, but writing a game that allows it to be played in a really like natural way. So having the rules be on cards, like in For the Queen, I think is an exceptional example of this, or in Raph's The Zone, which is available to play now. It truly is a zero prep that teaches you each step as you go through it. Like, people like me love to talk that this game involves zero prep, but like, kind of
what
not
does zero
really.
Prep really mean? Yeah,
it means I could run it with zero prep, but it doesn't mean shit for anybody else.
Yeah, everyone, mark your calendars for Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the Tabletop Call-In Show with Jeremy Cage and Adam Bell. It is awesome. It's a great show. They're doing great work over there. Check it the fuck out. Also check out Raph's The Zone, which you can find on that website, which is laughingkaiju.com, I believe.
It's also at thezonerpg.com. I just pulled it up real quick. That's where you can go play it right now.
The reason why we talk about Fiasco so much and our design based on Fiasco feels especially important based on like a lot of recent conversations, design conversations I had. It just made us and what we do here. So we're going to talk about it and shit like Quiet Year too. Like, you kind of can't talk about Fiasco enough. For what it like, we're not really still sure what happened back there with Fiasco.
It's magic. And you know what's funny too is I still haven't played the card version, but I bet
neither
it's great
have
too.
I. Yeah,
because it probably considers better this thing that we're talking about of being a jumping pad for players, and like, it seems like the card based stuff from the outside, having not experienced it, is a little bit more user friendly. And that's always great. Like, the more you can do to streamline play, not just like reading the rules and getting set up, but just being actually immersed in it.
Yeah,
is fantastic. And I think that they did consider that with the rebuild. And it's a thing I've become a little bit more cognizant of in design, especially this year. The thing we're working on, this other game that's not for my normal audience. But then there's also times where I make a game like Scratch and Claw and I'm like, you fucking got it. like
yeah.
Because that is for people who already know what I'm about and what the deal is. And like, it has one core mechanic, and like, it's not a game that really asks for more than that. I think that's the thing I talk about a lot too, of like what the game wants. And it's like, this game is cards that you scratch off and you want more cards, and like, you're probably gonna throw your cards away. So, like, does it need a book to go with it? Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
this is, like, a larger design thing happening with my design, where I know that I can make a labyrinthine story game that is off the chain, and is hard and weird and is different every time you play. And I can also make a game that is very easy and fine. And I want to do both. But I am worried that the audience of one will not come to the other. But then I think about the games that I myself like. Like, I love a Gamma World, which you cannot play that game without the book open in front of you. It's just not possible. The arrays, simply. The radiation rules. But I also love playing games like John Geary's Sledgehammer. Like, that game is a speedboat of a game. Yeah, it is a ball peen hammer of a game. Like, so we have this experience when we were playtesting this game. We still can't talk about I'm Sorry, but when it comes out, we can go back and listen to this episode. I'm like, oh, damn, they were talking about that. Damn. But every time we've playtested, it's like, wow, this was a really easy, free-flowing story game, and this felt great. Like,
yeah.
The relief that I've heard in playtest feedback for like, oh, that, like, the actual relief I could hear on people's voices was wild.
Yeah, a lot of games too. I think this is a thing that you're more considerate of than I am, and I'm trying to learn and like catch up, is like, even what I was just saying is easing a player into that play. So there, what I was talking before was sort of like this hard line of I am playing the game and I am getting ready to play the game.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you have the tutorial level mentality of like, you can ease into playing the game. It's not diving into, it's not a binary system. It's just like, walking into the shallow end of a pool instead of diving in. So each step you take, you're a little bit more in, but you're still like comforted by the disparity between the two. And before you know it, you're playing the game.
Yeah, you're
which is good. Like, that's a different thing. It has a lot of value. It's an interesting distinction, I think, between the immersive quality of a game that you are playing from setup. So something like The Zone, which is exceptionally well done, truly a zero prep. No one needs to know the rules. You just can go and it'll help you.
That's a TCP game, true zero prep.
And something like 10 Candles, where like you're playing when you light the candles, but also unless you have like a pretty intense familiarity with it, you're going to have that disparity between immersion and rules checking or, you know, facilitation, just by virtue of it being a different experience. And I think there's a spectrum I didn't consider before, because like obviously both of those are really great games and really unique experiences, but a lot of the time I have the hard line of like, you read the book and then you play the game, or you play the book, I guess that's not what I meant to say, but that's exactly what I mean. You play the book. Then there's somewhere in between on the spectrum of like the book Irish whips you into the game. And that's a different thing, and it's also really cool and valuable. And I think to bring it back to what I was talking about, some degree of play procedure, even in story stuff, especially in story stuff, can function in that way of making it feel really natural, but also revealing to the players, here's how all these components are working together. Yeah. In the same way that the spreadsheet can tell us as designers, the rules and the way that an early stage play procedure can inform the players of like, here's everything that's kind of at work here. Mm-hmm. And we're going to let you go do your thing in just a second, but like, this actually will help you. The tutorial level of like, I know X is jump, but did you know like this game doesn't have double jump? Or, you know, like there's still valuable things to learn, even if you think you're already beyond learning.
Yeah, players are always going to go and play, but we can give them like a couple different things to go on the field with. And when we explain that, like, here's like three ways to throw a frisbee, but you're going to figure out other ways to throw it, is valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a pretty bow on a long, winding subject of the cross-section of procedure and creativity.
Yeah, should we have said some more funny stuff?
Nah. We nailed it. So there is, we don't normally record using video, but we are today. Over your right shoulder, a ghost emoji, it's the ghost emoji that looks to be like a foot tall on top of a bookshelf.
Yeah, there is a ghost emoji there.
It maybe has lights in it or something.
Yeah, let me just get my screen bigger. So over here, we've got a ghost emoji. Seb, where's this from? I guess the underworld, right?
It's from the afterlife, yes. It's
from the afterlife. You're looking at this kind of Seb's work zone. Mine, I moved because it gets hot here now, so we had to get the air conditioner in, but...
I see the radiator.
This is a just super loud fucker. Oh, that radiator back there. Yeah, we've got a mega loud fucker that makes me turn on... fucking subtitles for Breaking Bad, so I know that Walt is asking Jesse when they can cook. Well,
yeah, that's been distracting me for the last hour, so I did need to bring it up.
The ghost,
the spook. Yeah, I'm afraid for you.
Okay, so now I'll talk about yours. Okay.
Yeah, it's mostly cardboard.
Let's get some art in here.
You know, when I moved in, there was still people. I talked about how the place above ours was vacant for like 5 months.
Yeah.
But when we first moved in, there was people. And now again, that there are people moving in, that I'm wary of like using a hammer to hang things, but I had 5 months of silence to use a hammer whenever I wanted. So I don't know what the fuck I was thinking, but I definitely, it is the maybe the only room in our place that has nothing on the walls.
Yeah. Because there's, I know, even, you have art, like
there's framed posters around the room on the ground as if they were going to be hung up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a,
so we,
all, we've all got, I've got is my sticky notes on the wall.
I'm fully sticky noted out. Oh, I have this new thing. So I've got a whiteboard, right? And it, I write on it. So I have all my client work and this freelance I have to do. But the pen I use is, the ink is different than what I'm normally used to. So when you write something, it is this crispy, just full black, just true black. But the longer you have a task up, the more faded it gets. So I can see here that I've got some freelance stuff that I have not thought about in a while, and it is almost invisible.
The degenerative aspect.
So I can see that, like, this thing where I have to check in with an artist next week, that is not going anywhere. That is absolute Helvetica black train station style deep blacks, and there is this just torque bullet point I have that I will, that seems
HP,
like,
is low.
HP is running low. The toner is not a lot. You might have to do the toner hack on that one, but yeah,
you got to bring in the death saves energy to your notes. Rolling stuff.
I kind of want to do that with my works in progress, like if it cannot resist death saves. If it's just been stagnant for so much time, I should just rip out the tech and post it for Tech Jam, which, by the way, is still going on, the Tech Jam. I think we have something like 16 submissions, so this is something that we will do regularly. There's clearly an interest. I know Adam Bell suggested in the Brain Trust that we should have a sister jam where people use the tech inside of just the tech packs posted to make games and just have a constant place to post games, so... I'm thinking that we just make it a big seasonal, or maybe every 2 months, having a tech jam with a discrete theme or something like that. Anyway, it's going great. That shit's awesome. Adam, where can people find you online?
I'm at WC Gameco on Twitter, and I'm worldchamp.io for my store, where you can buy Scratch and Claw cards and Necronautilus, and I think Babes in the Wood is coming out pretty soon. I've done it's the curse of all the spinning plates, but like Babes is good, and it went to print over a month ago, so like it's still a couple weeks from arriving here, but like after the Kickstarter I just had so much going on that I kind of forgot to continue talking about it.
Yeah.
So it's just gonna drop seemingly in like a couple weeks, and everyone's gonna remember, hopefully.
Yeah, but marketing is the hardest part of our jobs.
The combination of marketing and creating, of like wanting to make new things. Like Babes is done. I've been enjoying making new things for older games. Doing Adventures for Scratch and Claw. I'm gonna release a deck of cards for Aurora this week, which came out about a year ago now, so it's like the first support for that. So when Babes does come out, I'll probably write more adventure-y stuff. I did write a Psycho Goreman playbook for Babes great. That I can't it's rated R, so I probably won't make it publicly. I won't put it on the Babes itch page.
Yeah. But if you know, you know.
If you want it, I'll share it in the Brain Trust Discord or something. We'll plug.
I'm online at amazon.com/WillYobst. You can find all my stuff there. I just wanted to mention that, we'll have this announcement, I think, on the 1st of next month. So check it out. Torque development is going as fast as I can. Which is to say slow, because I'm doing the last month of my job that's almost up, and then I'm doing games full time, like Adam, and it's going to be great and really good. So expect a lot more progress then. What else? Hire me for shit. I'm a good editor. I'm a good project manager. I'm a good game writer. I edit this podcast and I sometimes know which of the compressions I prefer for which times. So yeah, just hire me. That would be awesome. And yeah, check out Tech Jam, brain emoji, handshake emoji.